Hey everyone, welcome to another exciting episode of the Scratch Track Podcast, presented by the Dude and Grim Show and co-produced by Mr. I-V-E-S-T. I'm the Dude.
And I am Grim, and today, saddle up at the table for a beggar's banquet.
We're begging.
By the Rolling Stones. Now, dude, you have a special version of this that was just re-released, I believe, correct?
The Record Store Day 2023, what, blue...
Gray, blue, black, and white.
Right version, which looks beautiful. And as you said on our previous podcast, which might be coming out either before, well, probably before this.
We don't know.
It looks a lot like a bowling ball. Like,
it does.
Yeah, the color is beautiful. We were just at the record shop. They had like five copies of it there. So if you are in need of this album or you want a second copy of it and you're into colored vinyl or just cool shit, definitely check this one out. It sounds and looks amazing.
I found mine a few years ago and didn't... There was nothing, I don't believe, that indicated that there was anything special about it, but it's clear, yeah. Which I think that was the first clear vinyl I had ever bought. And one thing I like about the clear ones is when they're on the platter, the grooves... On each side sort of fight with each other, and it gives this weird effect, warp. Like it's not spinning at a consistent rate.
Okay, I guess, is that what it is? Because yeah. I had another record, I forget. Oh, I have the Tattoo You Special Edition, and it does the same thing. I was like, man, that looks really, really weird. So that's what it is.
Yeah, it's visually the grooves underneath right. And on top fighting with, yeah.
Wow, that's pretty badass. Cool. Mm-hmm. So, well, dude, this is, I think, you know, this was released December 6, 1968, and this is what I would call the first of the big four.
Yeah.
That they released.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I don't like the fact that in their never-ending quest for greed and more money, it is the seventh British and ninth studio album by the Rolling Stones. And of course, just like they did with the Beatles, they would just repackage a bunch of songs that they had released and make different albums okay. So that they could sell more records and make more money. Because, I mean, I'm sure they were probably all those executives, you know, with all the talent and stuff are really hurting.
Well, so. This is the thing. And, you know, we don't have time to get into it. And it's very complicated. But this is also under, what is it, the ABKCO. Like Alan Klein's, Klein's thing. So it's like a lot of this stuff, I don't know. I think they did eventually settle not too many years ago. I think it was in the 2000s that they settled this, I guess lawsuit or whatever it was, because they were fighting for the rights to their songs, because essentially way back when they kind of just signed over the rights, not really knowing what they were doing.
Cause they're young and they're in a band and they're not trained in the business. Perusal of legal documents.
Yeah. And so they pretty much got screwed, and Alan Klein's company kind of had the rights. And I believe they still have the rights to a lot of their stuff from, like if you have the Hot Rocks album, they have the rights to that.
High Tide, Green Grass,
and even that a bunch, been another one. Yeah, even a bunch of songs off of. I mean, I think Let It Bleed, some of the songs, and maybe even some of the Sticky Fingers tracks.
Oh wow!
Because they said
it was what sessions, right?
Some of the songs were recorded during those sessions. So, anyways, little side trip.
If anyone knows, you know, after you go ahead and do the obvious. Let us know, because it's something that I read at one point, but there's a lot of things, a lot of strands in the old duder's head.
Yeah, and it's really sort of complicated. Like even reading like on the Wikipedia, like how everything kind of went down. I feel like there should be like a documentary about it or something, and maybe there is.
There's a really good podcast that covers a lot of these things, and I believe it is, because it's the podcast is the 500 songs that like made rock and roll or whatever. A History of Rock Music and 500 Songs. Love the podcast. And I don't know if it was a full episode or a partial one, but he did one on Street Fighting Man. So based on the time period, it gets into all these things.
Cool. Well, yeah. Speaking of Street Fighting Man, we should talk a little bit more about the album. You know, so actually one question I had, of the big four, where do you rank this one? And the big four we're talking about, Beggar's Banquet, Let It Bleed, Sticky Fingers, Exile on Main Street.
Second.
Rank it second.
Ah, ooh, I don't know.
Exile's first.
Because Let It, yeah, Exile has got to be. But dude, yeah. Let It Bleed is so choice too. I mean, they're all great, but I can tell you, Sticky Fingers is four for me. So okay. this one's fighting for a second or third spot.
See, Sticky Fingers for me, I would either go with one or two because it has my favorite Rolling Stone song on it.
Oh,
Can You Hear Me Knocking?
Yeah,
that's and it. Dude, I mean, dude, Dead Flowers, man.
Oh, I know it's a great album. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, but yeah, it's. Yeah, I'd put this one
Simply for the Devil.
I know. Oof. I mean, dude, I love all the songs on this one too.
You know, interestingly enough, so think about Can't You Hear Me Knocking?
Yep.
And Sympathy for the Devil.
Yep.
Now, one thing is, I think, like, I mean, I would argue two of my favorite Rolling Stone songs. I don't know why
Yeah.
I'd have to look back to see what I would rank them or something, yep. But not that anyone cares, but both of these songs really experiment with like Latin rhythms.
Sure. Yeah.
And that's interesting because it was like that little bit of experimentation, which I read about in actually Sympathy for the Devil, that they just like tried doing it a bunch of different ways. And Keith suggested doing like shakers and that sort of rhythm section along with the drums. And of course that one stuck. But I just think it's interesting that two of their best songs had like that same type of experimentation in it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this album is a real, just kind of a departure for them. It was a new, they were going into a new area. Mm-hmm. You can tell it's, you know, they're doing less of the psychedelic noodling, right?
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, getting into sort of more just like the, kind of like the just blues rock. We got some country folk stuff on here. It was a turning page, I really think, for the band. And obviously, you know, it's documented pretty heavily, you know, Brian Jones's downfall.
Yeah.
But this is where here's the thing. He's a founding member, like huge integral part of their success up to this point in the band. And it's very similar in a way to like we talked about like Pink Floyd, where you lose one of, I mean, for Pink Floyd, Syd Barrett goes away.
Yeah.
You lose one of your basically creative geniuses. And it's kind of like, well, where do you go? What do you do? I mean, Pink Floyd, I think, was a little more dramatic maybe than this.
Yeah, because Mick and Keith, to me, like, they really took the reins.
They did.
Ideally, you liked this one because you should have been made aware that this was where they were going now.
Yeah.
And I think somebody in at least the Wiki article referred to it, I think, very aptly as their coming of age album.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. I think that makes a lot of sense. It is. It's just kind of getting, they're like, okay, we've done. I mean, what? It's 68. I mean, at the end of 68, December of 68, I mean, I would have to look up and see what the Beatles were coming out with at this same time.
I believe the release of the single Revolution coincided roughly
with Street Fighting Man,
because this was summer of 68, was a lot of like protests and riots. Now, maybe we'll get into that when we get into the song. So, I don't know if this was the first album of theirs. Oh, it was the first album produced by Jimmy Miller.
Yes.
And he became, and I didn't know this, I guess, for a long time until we started doing this podcast and I would read more.
I mean, like three years ago. We have a whole backlog. Check them out.
Has it really been that long?
Dude, we just had our three-year anniversary.
Yes. Wow. Happy anniversary, dude.
Thank you, man.
This is our anniversary dinner. Jimmy Miller was very important in sort of developing them through this period in that sound.
Mm-hmm.
And I think knowing that he was at the helm for like the big four, I mean, that says something. I mean, I'd put that on my resume if I was him.
Yeah, I'd lead with that.
Yeah, I'd actually just hand him, I'd mail him a copy of the record and be like, here's my resume, jerk off.
Yeah, I think that would go over really well. Now, the cover of the album.
Yeah.
Initially, so this is the cover I've always known.
Me too.
And initially rejected by the record company. I mean, if you look at it, it's a, It's a pretty industrial looking, sort of gross.
It looks like a gas station bathroom.
Yeah, a gas station bathroom. Like,
it's hell, it's even got the Champion, which they make car parts. And so that kind of goes with that. Yeah. And that bar of soap's just sitting on the top of the toilet.
Oh, that bar of soap, it's man. Awesome. Oh. That's gross. But dude, what is cool, I believe, I don't know if it's on here or it's on the back. But don't they list, aren't there all the titles?
Oh, yeah, on the back.
Of the songs and everything? It's all on the back. So.
Yeah. And, dude, I love how they have Thanks, Nikki Hopkins, who we'll get to. Yeah, and they have little pictures for a lot of them.
Prodigal Son.
One thing I noticed just now, and I will, I can.
Dear Doctor.
Yeah. I can show you on the front of this one, which I think is funny. So. They blurted out, but one of my favorite bathroom sayings, here I sit so brokenhearted, came to shit and only farted. But they kind of like blurred out the...
Dude, that's sweet. I imagine mine's blurred out too. Yep,
they're all blurred out.
I mean, it's... I just think it's pretty cool that they did this. Now, there is another version. They kind of... I think during the 50th anniversary of it... I guess it was 50.
They released the original.
They released the original cover, and it's just kind of like... It's almost like it's white and in gold. They have... It's like written like in Old English or whatever, I think.
Like cursive.
Cursive, I guess. Not old English, but cursive.
Same thing to me.
Yeah. So, I mean, who writes, you know, by hand anymore anyway?
Yeah, and it's funny. At the bottom left corner of it, it says RSVP, like RSVP to the banquet. Yeah, but it's, to me... This cover goes with everything. It goes with the subject matter. It goes with all of it. And the other one is very, very like, well, shit, we got to do something. So here you go.
Yeah, it's kind of,
tame. Now, this seemed to have kind of mixed criticism at the time. Some people really praised it as like a coming of age and all this stuff. And other people said it was really raw and raucous and arrogant and, you know, a lot of things. And I guess you can think, I can think of why, because he references we'll talk about it probably in the song too, but in Sympathy for the Devil, the opening track, he brings up killing the Kennedys, the brothers.
Yeah.
Dude, that was like 3 to 4 years ago. Like, you know,
I think, well, what year now, was Bob, what year was Bob? I think Bobby was killed in 68.
Oh, yeah. And so they changed.
So originally, and yeah, we'll just talk about it now. So the, it originally was, you know, they killed the Kennedy or they killed Kennedy.
Yeah.
But Bobby was killed in 68. He changed it to the Kennedys.
And dude, when you think about that, that is like a too soon moment. You know what I mean? Like you can see why people would be like, holy shit, this is a little, you know, because
after all, it was you and me.
Yeah. He's got a point there. Or Sirhan in that case of Bobby.
Exactly. So, I mean, they definitely started poking the bear a little bit politically with this.
Oh, yeah.
You know, obviously with Street Fighting Man and stuff. But one thing I never noticed and I found pretty crazy when we were just discussing it this morning, but in 2002, they reissued Beggar's Banquet, but originally, so for 30 years, we'd been hearing it one way. And so when it was originally mastered, it was mastered actually, there was some sort of error. It was a little slower. So when they released this, they corrected the flaw and every song is in a slightly, it's slightly faster now.
Increased speed and
exactly.
And pitch.
And pitch, yeah, the key of the songs. And so, but the time difference, the album is actually 30 seconds faster or shorter now because
it's it's longer because they slowed it down.
Oh, they slowed it down,
So it's 30 seconds more than it originally was.
Exactly, yeah, that's what I mean. And that's really interesting. Now, for me, I mean, I guess I had always heard it. I'm trying to think what year I really, really even got into this album.
I know.
And when I had copies of stuff, like, I don't know, because this, I mean, obviously is new.
When I listened to this and we listened to it, you know, for our warm up.
Yes.
I can't find any fault or I've never heard any of these songs and thought to myself like something's wrong here. But I will say, growing up listening to classic rock radio, I know damn well I heard Sympathy for the Devil many times. And before that remaster happened. Yeah. And I can't say that I know I ever really, and that's what I wonder, like, you're probably not even talking a whole semitone.
Yeah.
And a semitone is just like one key to the next on a piano. Like, it's probably not even a whole semitone different.
Yeah.
It just ever so slightly.
Yeah.
But it's weird. I've never heard of that. People intentionally change speed of some things. Yeah.
Well, I find it interesting that it happened in 2002. Like, it didn't, like, when this originally came out on CD, you know, it seems like that's kind of when you'd be like, hey, we're going to fix this problem. We're going to do this. And I mean, if you're the band and you pick up a copy of it, I mean, I don't know, after they're done recording it, maybe, I mean, you're probably not sitting around listening to your music. I mean, you know, maybe they just, hey, you know, hey, we finished these songs and, you know, we finished the songs, we sent the album out to get pressed and we're kind of good. But I would imagine
you would at some point you'd hear it and be like, that's a little off.
Yeah, man. Something's going on. Like, what's the deal here? But
I'd really like to hear. I bet we could. And if anyone knows of any of these things, because I'm sure they exist on YouTube.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
And I would like to hear that. So if you know about it, let us know.
Something below. Yeah. Well, I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to cover before we got into the tracks.
No. No, I think. Oh, I did want to address one of the critics, and not by name because I don't know what the name is and I don't even know what the publication was at the time, but one of the criticisms, somebody wrote that this album, what really carried the album was Mick Jagger's vocal delivery. Now, although it's awesome, no question about it, I just find that statement incredibly ignorant.
Okay.
Like, musically, think about what they're doing here versus what they've done in the past. Like, it's all really well done. And I just, that one really rubbed me the wrong way when I read that, because I was like, get this jerk off. Like, you shouldn't be writing, because that you're so off base.
It's that isn't. Yeah. I mean, I'd be curious to read that sort of full interview and what else he had to say.
Oh, it was Melody Maker.
Okay.
So somebody, it doesn't even say, it just says the writer of Melody Maker's initial review called the album mediocre and said that since the Stones are Mick Jagger, it was only the singer's remarkable recording presence that makes this LP. Sorry, that is incorrect.
Yeah, that's crazy, because this, I mean, to this point, this is obviously far and away the most diverse album that they had put out.
Yeah.
And maybe that was sort of like the initial reaction. Because here's the thing. If you think about what they've put out up into this point, you know, pretty, I mean, they did some things, some cool things, but, you know, fairly consistent. You kind of knew what you were going to get a little bit with a Stones album. And then they come out with this and you're like, man, are they like, they're searching for a direction. It's all over the place and everything. I can understand that being at the time, you got to put yourself back, you know, in 1968 when you hear that. And
this is, I would be like, this is cool.
Very true. Very true. But I mean, it's easy for us to say that now. It is very easy.
True.
For us to
say and that that's, now. I think that's an important point, because there's things that we may not really be that into when they come out, but in retrospect were very much more important than I think they were given credit for.
Yeah.
And I think other than that one particular genius, a lot of people rated it really highly just because of the diversity. And I think it would be very hard to not have a conversation about their music up to this point without a comparison to the Beatles, whether right or wrong, there's always going to be that comparison. It's like the Beatles and the Stones are the two biggest bands in Britain. And I feel like there was like a very friendly sort of, maybe not a rivalry, but there was
definitely a rivalry.
But they were obviously very friendly with each other.
Yeah. I mean, they hung out and they did shit. I mean, you know, they even formed a super group, the Dirty Mac. I mean, you know,
so I think this,
they did drugs together.
this takes them away, because although, you know, the Beatles' White Album came out in 68 also, and there was some more acoustic that was very different for them as well.
Yeah.
But I don't, they were never going to do blues and country as good as the Rolling Stones.
Not, they just don't.
Not I'm like sorry.
Here's the thing. When I listen to the Beatles, even if you listen to like the White Album, which to me is like, is kind of like as raw as like the Beatles really get. The Stones just, I think, embody just like kind of rawness. Like that's when, like the Beatles, I think of as more polished.
Yeah.
They wanted to do awesome stuff in the studio and explore that space and whatnot. And hey, the Stones stuff sounds good, but you know, that's one of the biggest criticisms of about Exile on Main Street too, is a lot of people are like, oh man, you know, I've heard people say, oh, it sounds like shit in like a lot of these songs. And I'm like, man, I think it sounds great. And even if, you know, not everything just has to sound so crystal clear and perfect. Like
that's why a lot people like punk.
It gives it character and personality, you know? So
one thing was interesting that I wanted to know, and I don't remember which songs particularly, except Street Fighting Man was a clear example, but they said that it was recorded on some sort of a cassette recorder.
Yeah. So Keith had, Street Fighting Man was one of them, but Keith had like a cassette recorder. Now, I don't think it's like a hand recorder, you know, like we know. But do you remember in Gimme Shelter how they're sitting in one of their hotel rooms and he's got like a tape?
It's like
a tape machine, and it's like reel to reel, so it's like, you know, a little higher quality tape. And I'm curious if it's something like that, because I have here in my notes. So I think it was Charlie Watts who said this. It may have been Charlie Watts.
He had a shitty drum kit or something.
Oh, there was that too. But Keith loved playing with early cassette machines because they would overload. And when they overloaded, they sounded fantastic, although they weren't meant to do that.
Well, that holds absolutely then, because I even made the comment to you earlier about the way his guitar sounds on that. Like it's an acoustic guitar, but it's compressed to hell, and it's pushing it too hard.
Yeah.
And I think that's interesting, because it's not that different from the concept of even on a real nice reel to reel machine, like redlining it, because when you redline it, the way that tape distorts is nice. It's not like digital distortion where it's just shitty and crummy.
Yeah, yeah.
It has like this warmth and
a richness,
buzz to
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Fridge Buzz
Productions.
So, I don't know, with that,
I think we should go ahead.
Get into the tracks.
So, let's go.
Track right, mate.
Number one. Probably, is this the most popular song off the album, maybe? Sympathy for the Devil?
I think so.
Yeah.
Even though Street Fighting Man is, that you could make that debate, I just think more people know Sympathy for the Devil.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, because you could never get the woo out of your head.
Right.
You just can't.
Yeah. Interestingly, Street Fighting Man was the lone single from the album. So even Sympathy was not even a single.
And it's interesting to me, because I knew this well before I was really into the Rolling Stones. And that was the song that I really knew off Beggar's Banquet. I didn't even know Street Fighting Man until I bought that London Years Singles Collection on CD, like when I was in high school.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then those were the only two songs I knew off the album, but I knew Sympathy for the Devil first because it was on the radio a lot.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
dude, even for classic rock radio, and this is past the point where not every song had to be a 3-minute masterpiece.
Yeah.
Dude, it's still over 6 minutes long.
Yeah.
It's a long song.
Like it's long. It's definitely long. It's funny. This song, you know, it's definitely one of their, you know, most popular. I know it. I think a lot of people, you know, were kind of trying to understand where the Stones were coming from, and like, oh, okay, are they getting you have a song called Sympathy for the Devil, like, you know, way back then, you know, well, you still have religious groups today, but people are like, oh man, we don't want our kids listening to this
stuff.
Like, what's going on, what are they talking about?
Interesting, it's like looking at these really bad things that happened in human history, like through the perspective of the day, you know.
Yeah, right.
It's you know, back to the whole Kennedys thing, I love that line about, after all, it was you and me. Now that is trippy because, I don't know.
It probably deserves further, deeper discussion of what that could even mean.
But it's real. It was real ballsy, I think, to put this out in light of how recently those things happened. Like, you realize why people would call the album things like arrogant and, sure, and all that stuff, yeah, because it's like, man.
Yeah. Well, it's funny how, so they said, you know, the working title for this initially was the Devil Is My Name, but an earlier title from that, the song was called Fallen Angels.
Yeah.
And I find that, you know, we go from Fallen Angels to The Devil Is My Name to Sympathy for the Devil.
I know.
It's quite the progression.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
Yeah. But I, you know, it was interesting, you know, how I think you said earlier, you, that it, they played this song and tried it a bunch of different ways. Yep. And
Keith suggested the like lazy Latin jazz.
Ooh, I like thing. That. You like that? Yeah. But yeah, man, I really dig it. And one thing a lot of people said, if you remember in the Altamont Speedway,
dude, in that version, by the way, I love it when they take it electric. Dude, it's thick, man.
Well, and that's what's cool is, you know, sometimes, you know, bands will do that, right? Where the live version differs, you know, significantly from the studio version. And this, it just has, again, that loud, ballsy rawness, right?
Yeah, and they do that with a couple in that particular concert. The version of Under My Thumb that they do is also really good. But yeah, I like that because so much of this song is driven by just that piano. And Keith does a good job of adopting that into a really nice guitar lick and making it work.
Well, a lot of people had reported, or when they talk about the Altamont Speedway concert, saying that the guy who got stabbed, they say, like, it's reported that it happened during this song when it actually didn't. It happened during
Under My Thumb.
Yeah. But for some reason, a lot of the news reports were, so that added some, you know, some drama and almost, I don't know if it's a mystique around it, but it's like, oh, and then they start playing Sympathy for the Devil and someone gets stabbed and killed, right?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, thanks, Hell's Angel. Yeah. Rubbish. But also, too, man, you know, the song is referenced, like, Hunter Thompson in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. This song is referenced a lot in the book and in the movie. And it's, apparently it's a song that him and, you know,
his partner in crime, I can't remember his name. Benicio del Toro.
They call him Dr. Gonzo.
Yeah.
Is what, you know, how we talk.
But it's like Oscar
Zeta or something like that. Yeah. They were listening to this song a lot, or almost, I think, repeatedly on their drive when they were going out to Vegas and everything.
That makes sense.
That's pretty.
Let's do some drugs and listen to it right now.
Damn, I feel like we should watch that later. Yeah. We haven't seen that. Yeah. Let's fall asleep to that. So yeah, I think I don't know. Maybe, well, you did mention the woo woo.
Oh yes,
go ahead.
Well, it's interesting because of all people, it sounds like Anita Pallenberg, who I think at the time was Keith's girlfriend
or partner or whatever.
A lot of intermingling, but her and Marianne Faithfull and others contributed to those vocals. But I just thought it was interesting that whole thing happened by accident. And dude, you can never think of this song without that bit. It's you know, if you didn't know this, you'd be like, yeah, it's the one where they go woo woo, and everyone would know what you're talking about.
Well, it's funny because it was when they were in the studio. Mick is putting in his vocals, and Jimmy Miller, who's the producer, is he just kind of started like humming or like kind of like singing along, and he was saying hoo hoo.
Yeah.
And then basically he got, you know, Mick got done with the take and he came back in and Nita was like, hey, that's, you know, really good. Like, this is really good. You should put that in there.
Yeah.
And somehow it got changed into woo woo. But I thought I thought it was pretty cool.
No expectations.
I have none, Graham. I have no expectations in this.
Now, this is a, one thing I didn't, I didn't realize until reading this a little more that I found really interesting was that both in the way that the lyrics are presented, the way it's written, mm-hmm. what it's about, and sort of stylistically, it's almost like they're tribute to Robert Johnson's Love in Vain, right. which they covered.
Yes.
Yeah. But it makes it, it has a similar feel, and just like the idea of like the train and the yeah. and the light and like all that shit. And yep. I never put that together until reading that, but that makes a lot of sense.
It's pretty cool. And it does. It does sound a lot. It has the Love in Vain. I mean, it's that dude, that slide. I mean,
yeah,
which Brian Jones plays.
And they say, and yeah. And I think Mick said that was like his last thing that he recorded and took great care of, or in great pride yeah. in was that part. And it's, you couldn't have that right. song without that part. Yeah. Really.
And it's funny, you know, we didn't really even touch a ton on Brian Jones and stuff. And I'm sure we'll bring it up a little more as these, you know, we go through the songs, but you know, this is, I mean, he played on what I think two songs on Let It Bleed, like where he had a couple little parts, but basically this was his real downfall. Like he wasn't showing up. I mean, it's kind of the classic story, right? Of the, you know, rock star not showing up to the sessions. Yep, yep. You know, it's like Jim Morrison wouldn't show up, or Sid mm-hmm. Barrett wasn't showing up, or they're late, or they're fucked up when they get there and stuff. And you know, they, one of the stories that they talk about, I forget what track, maybe it's Street Fighting Man, where like he would. When he did show up, he showed up with a sitar, and they were like, yeah, that's awesome.
That's not what we're really doing.
That's not going to fit this song. Like we're not,
they made it though,
you know? Well, yeah, but they took him and they like put him in an isolation booth and we're just kind of like, it was almost like appeasing him.
Oh yeah. Just like, piss off and let us do the real work here.
So
yeah. Now this is the first song on the album that there were some keyboard instruments that I think both Brian Jones and Nicky Hopkins, who ended up being the main contributor for keys, put in. And I didn't recognize, because they reference a Farfisa organ in No Expectations. Now, out of the two types of organs that were used at the time, the Farfisa organ, you could remember when we did the Gorillaz, that is that organ. And it does not fit with the sound of that song.
That's true, yeah.
But they made it fit, I think, with like fade ins and whatever. But it really works. I mean, in my mind, you'd do a Hammond on that. But I don't know. I just, that one really surprised me. And then we'll get into it in the other songs, but there was a lot of Mellotron used in the album, which makes sense because that instrument was relatively new at the time. The Beatles had used
it. Everybody's like, oh, it's something new and sweet. We just got to find a way to put it in there, right?
And if you have access to it, I'm sure the first time people played one, you were like, this is so fucking...
Yeah.
It was the original sampler.
Awesome. Yeah.
I mean...
Yeah. Well, it was one thing I did before we move on to the next song. When they were recording this, like it says, they all sat around in a circle on the floor, like playing and singing, and they just recorded it like with open mics. Like,
oh, that's cool. That's really cool. I didn't write know that.
Yeah. So then we go to track number three.
Dear Doctor. Now, I think this is the first time that the Stones went country. Would not be their last.
No.
But one,
and I love most of their country shit.
It's, I do too. Great. I love the country honk, the version of Honky Tonk Women that they do country.
Yep.
And like Mick overemphasizes doing the hillbilly sort of southern accent, but I think it's great. Yeah. And one thing they said in the articles that we were reading about it that was interesting to me was they appreciated that a lot of country music wasn't always so serious, and they would look at these situations that were maybe sort of tougher situations, but sort of talk about them in like a humorous way, like a lighthearted and humorous way.
Sure.
And I mean, that this song is a perfect example of that. It's somebody getting stood up at the altar, but it turns out they didn't really want to get married anyway, so it kind of worked out.
The joke's on you.
Yeah, I hope you and Luke have fun. My cousin Luke have fun in Virginia.
Yeah, right. Moving on, track number four, Parachute Woman. again, Brian Jones, you know, plays the acoustic and harmonica on, this, on this track as well. And, you know, it's interesting. We didn't mention this in some of the previous ones, but with Dear Doctor, they never, they've never played that one live. Parachute Woman, they've only played it twice. One on the Rock and Roll Circus. And if you guys are fans of this album and have not seen the Rock and Roll Circus, either seen it or heard it, it's awesome. I think that's the first time they played
all any these, of those these songs live. Because it was, that also took place in December. Like if it wasn't right after the release, it was like almost lined up. So that actually would have been really cool because most of their set consisted of
So it was like Sympathy, Salt of the Earth, Parachute Woman, and then there was probably, and then I know they played You Can't Always Get What You Want. It might have been those four. I don't know if they did any more tracks. I have to look at the list.
We'll pull out our box set vinyl and make some notes.
But yeah, I mean, it's a, you know, it's a good song. It's one of the it's like just over 2 minutes, so it is a very short song.
Well, and I guess in true to form with like blues lyrics, some serious heavy-handed innuendo stuff that was like barely okay at the time. My heavy throbbers itching just to lay a solid rhythm down. I didn't even realize that's what he said, but when I read it, I was like, wow.
Well, then we move on to Jigsaw Puzzle, which is, you know, I never realized until they kind of mentioned it, is like, this is almost as long as Sympathy. Like, it's a long song. And I really like it. I think it's a just kind of a fun, playful kind of, like, I love the...
But there's a little bit of sadness to it.
There is, yeah.
Dude, I feel like this song is their most Bob Dylan-like song.
I can see that, for sure.
Because it doesn't change a whole lot, and there's a lot of lyrics, but it just moves along, and the lyrics are interesting and can be somewhat abstract, but I like how they use the device of the jigsaw puzzle.
Absolutely, like, it's kind of, you know, it's how the pieces all sort of fit together. But, and I even like how, you know, there's the section... where he's singing, and it's almost like he's singing about, I feel like, the Stones, and like he says, oh, the singer, he looks so angry at being thrown at the lines, and the bass player, he looks nervous about the girls outside, and the drummer, he's so shattered trying to keep on time, and the guitar players look damaged, they've been outcasts all their lives.
Like, I know.
I mean, I think it's really sort of cool. Like a biographical, autobiographical way to incorporate just kind of how you see yourself and putting it in the song.
I know. It is neat. That is really cool. Yeah. And I love how he also foreshadows one of the other greatest Rolling Stones song ever, Shattered. He didn't know it at the time, probably. But Shattered would
come to fruition. So now we flip it over to side two. Street Fighting Man. And this is it. So originally was titled Did Everyone Pay Their Dues? And was, I found it interesting too. Originally written with different lyrics. And then because of all the violence and political things going on and whatnot, he changed the lyrics to kind of really address it and make it, I don't know if I'd say like a rise up song,
but a protest song. So you had in that summer, which was a very troubled summer, I think probably more so in the U.S.
Yeah.
I mean, but over there as well, you had Revolution come out by the Beatles. You had Street Fighting Man come out. And dude, think of how fuzzy and nasty Revolution sound. The Beatles had never sounded that hard.
Not the one on the White Album. Like
correct.
The,
yeah, not the number nine.
Yeah.
That's exactly. A real gem there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just think that's interesting. And then conversely, another band had a song, and I don't know if it actually came out, but do you know Pink Floyd's Summer of 68?
I know Pink Floyd and I know that song.
It's not so much a protest song like the other one.
Okay,
it was about some relationship with a girl that didn't work out by Rick Ray.
They were working it out.
Yeah. At the time. Yeah. So that made it seem like the summer was a little more pleasant.
Right. Well, many radio stations, like this was released as a single, and a lot of radio stations
refused to play it
because they were worried that it would incite more violence. And so this is like, I don't have the number in front of me, but it was like, the this it did not chart well because of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's like, I think it got up in like the 40s or something. So it's like the lowest charting Rolling Stones single of all time or something.
Now, do you know the most awesome shout out for Street Fighting Man that was in a movie?
No.
I think it was the movie Dirty Work starring Norm Macdonald. I think it was Dirty Work, but Chris Farley had a small part in it.
Yeah.
And he wanted to, like, he was about to start a bar fight. And he goes, Rolling Stone, Street Fighting Man, G7. Oh. And somebody goes, you just hit G8. And then it comes out. Instead of Street Fighting Man, it's like, if you like pina
colada. That's fucking great.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Oh, God. Well, also, you know, we should move on a little quicker here, but the Charlie Watts plays a 1930s toy drum kit. It was called a London Jazz, I think Kent set, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And he bought it at an antique shop, and it came in like a little suitcase and everything. And I'm just like, dude, I mean, that's amazing. Dude, you're in one of the biggest bands in the world. You're recording, you know, this new album. You know, like, you know what? I'm going to use this drum set.
Well, a lot of people use toy pianos on stuff sometimes because the sound is just so, and it does have a weird sound. And because they use that, the old tape recorder thing too, I think they just blasted it out.
Yeah.
You know,
blasted it out.
Yeah. So next is, I would say, I mean, the Stones always did rhythm and blues, right?
Yep.
And they were seriously influenced. They actually saw themselves in the early days as like scholars of rhythm and blues music. Like they had an encyclopedic knowledge of it. Like I think somebody noted that Mick Jagger had like an encyclopedic knowledge of the blues and stuff. But this song, Prodigal Son, to me is the first one that they did where they weren't trying to like take a 60s rock group take on the blues. It was like so much more true to form.
Yep.
And
it is one of my favorite songs of the album. I mean,
easily.
Yeah.
Yep. Easily. And I think it should be noted that they did not write this song.
Right.
It was a cover of a song, which I think is, I would have assumed that, but you know, they get credited with writing it, and so you figure, I'm sure they did a slightly updated take on it, but
it is. Yeah. I mean, I love it. I think it's phenomenal. now,
it's Robert Wilkinson.
Okay,
and his original, I think he had a song of the same name, but I mean, it's so rooted in the biblical story of obviously the prodigal son.
Yes. Which is, now we go, dude. I think the dirtiest song on the album, at least in my opinion, is Stray Cat Blues.
Well, like, dirty from the sense of basically being about statutory rape.
Well, there's also that. Well. But I mean, in the sound.
I know. And that's the thing, like the subject matter, I couldn't imagine writing that song, like the lyrics, but the sound of it is so good that it's like.
It is.
Yeah.
It's really good. But
I just am like, man, if people had a problem with Sympathy for the Devil, like fathers, lock up your daughters for this one.
Yeah, pretty much. Dude, but yeah, so it's, you know, the song is, it's essentially told from the perspective of a man lusting for illegal sex with a 15-year-old groupie.
Yeah.
Dude, now during the performance of Get Your Yayas Out, it's
13-year-old.
Yeah. And it's like, oh my God, you're going in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
I would have went with 16. It would still, I mean,
I wonder if they're playing this on their current tour.
Well, I mean, if you look at it, Mick Jagger might be currently married to like a teenager because his wife is so young. It's like grandpa dad.
Yeah, pretty much.
Fucking weird.
Yeah. So now we go.
Factory Girl.
Dude, again, very folky and just like, I guess, what is it? Dear Country. Doctor. Yeah. You know, like they're taking like this kind of fun, like lighthearted, I guess, kind of humorous sort of look at the country stuff.
And it's just a song about a girl, but it seems real. You know, it's not like writing a song about some beauty queen that you'll never be able to get and you just like fantasize, which I'm sure there's a lot of songs about that.
Yeah.
This is waiting for the girl to come out of her trailer so you can go get drunk on Friday night at the, you know, that's, and they say all those things.
You know, there's probably a lot more of those people out there.
She ain't come out yet.
She's real. Yeah, she ain't come out yet. Dude, I love the, I mean, I love the acousticness of it, but it's the song. It sounds very crisp to mm-hmm. me. And so, like, we talk about how they're, you know, the Stones, when they do a lot of their stuff, it can be a little muddy and raw and stuff like that. This song is like, it's very clean.
Well, and I think part of that too is the guitar is played very percussive as opposed to being strummed.
Yeah,
his playing is like finger style percussive. Sure. And so that adds a little bit of sharpness too, just in like the attack and, you know, the sound waves would be like.
Yeah, totally. And then we go to the last track, which I think is a phenomenal, you know, like this is where this song belongs, Salt of the Earth.
And I think that he was, or at least people would say that this was kind of influenced by like John Lennon's sort of highlighting the plight of the working man, you know, and then again, with the biblical reference of the salt of the earth,
which
is a great reference.
Yeah.
And I love that Keith sings.
Yeah, it's cool. Keith, it's funny. He has, I mean, dude, and then what? And Let It Bleed, he's got You Got the Silver, right?
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, if you've ever seen Keith do his songs live, it might leave a little something to be desired.
Yeah.
But in the studio,
it works
and it works very, very well. And I just, dude, it's like, man, let's drink to the hardworking people.
Yeah.
Like,
and when they sing together, it really.
Oh, yeah. Well, and then you get that, you know, the whole chorus, like everybody almost like,
yes.
You know, you have the female vocals in the background and everything. And it song just comes together like really, really.
Piano really comes nicely. Nicky Hopkins just crushing it.
It's good stuff.
As always.
Yeah. So that pretty much brings us to the end here.
The most difficult part.
Yes. It's time to scratch. And we do have to scratch. Now, do you want to go first or do you want me to?
Yeah, sure. I'll go first.
You're going to go first. Okay. He's going to go first.
This is a real tough one. And there is a very good chance that we're going into OT because of how tough this one is.
Yeah.
I would say, and it's not because I don't like it, because I very much do like it. I like the feel of it and all. But if I was going to scratch one, I would scratch Parachute Woman.
Yeah, we're going overtime. OT's on. Mark it.
Okay.
I agree with that. You know, again, this is such a classic, exceptional album that this makes it very difficult. You know, it is a shorter song. I would be perfectly happy going, you know, from a Dear Doctor right into Jigsaw Puzzle.
Yeah, sure.
And everything. And, you know, I'm just trying to think, like, I don't know if I could cut anything else, you know, like what I would cut next. So what would you cut next if we're going to overtime?
I had a speech all prepared, but today I'm going to speak from the heart. Actually, Stray Cat Blues.
Wow.
Not because I love the song, but subject matter wise, a little rough.
There's that. Yeah,
kind of. And the thing is, to me, the other songs are just so important to the album, the sound of it. You know, like that song, not that it doesn't belong, but. Mm-hmm. It's not, it just doesn't have, it's sort of lacking in terms of variation. Great song, sure. But I mean, yeah.
So.
Double OT?
So there's a part of me, no, I can't do that one. So, and not because I don't like it, maybe because I've heard it a lot, but there's a part of me that could do Street Fighting Man.
Considered that one. I considered that one.
And I think that song, I think it stands sort of on its own. Like, I think that song could just be a single, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know how bands would just like just release a single or, you know, be a part of an EP or something like that.
Well, I'm not going to, I'm not throwing out a WTF okay. ITS on that.
And this song had been around for a bit too.
Yeah.
So I think of all the songs, it is one of the older ones. So
I did consider that one.
You know, and is it, you know, would you say that it is sort of an outlier compared to the rest of the songs?
In some ways.
A little bit.
Yeah. Because you have sort of this, like, you're even though it's done on an acoustic, it sounds almost more electric than anything else.
100%. Yeah.
I can't put my finger on it, but it sounds more electric than a lot of the other songs, even though in a lot of sense it isn't.
Right. So those are our scratches. We're going to wrap things up here.
Let us know yours.
Let us know what you guys would scratch. Tell us why you wouldn't scratch the ones that we scratched. And where do you guys rank this in Rolling Stone's, I guess, the big four that we have? But, you know, where do you rank it?
Do you have a big four that doesn't include this? Maybe yours is like Steel Wheels, Tattoo You,
and yeah, it could
whatever
be
the hell they put out after that.
Yeah. I don't know. Some good stuff. So, all right. That pretty much wraps it up, guys. Thank you so much for watching. And we got some amazing stuff coming up next.
Time to go.
The Duke Grimm Show. Grimm Show.
Scratch a Track is produced by the Dude Grimm. Additional music provided by Moore and the Timms. Copyright 2023. The Dude and Grimm Show.